Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie, sponsored by Baillie Gifford. I'm Charlotte Metcalfe and today I'm delighted to have with me the eminent broadcaster and much loved presenter of the Today programme for 10 years, Ed Sturton. Ed has worked in broadcasting for well over 40 years and continues to present Radio 4 programmes like The World at One, The World This Weekend, Analysis and Sunday, an absolute must for all Radio 4 listeners up early on a Sunday morning and in need of some balm for the soul. He's also been a foreign correspondent for Channel 4, ITN, the BBC, and is the author of several books on a variety of topics, from a biography of Pope John Paul II and a history of the BBC during the war to being a dog walker, diary of a dog walker. He's known for his good manners and his non-confrontational style, which is nevertheless underpinned by a mighty and tough intellect. Ed, it's a joy to have you on Radio Oldie. Good morning.
And Charlotte, what an embarrassingly sort of flattering introduction. I do find nowadays that when people, in the very kind way that you've just done, read out what I've sort of done in the course of my life, I just feel incredibly old. well, it is the oldie.
So it is the oldie. And I'm incredibly old too. So hooray. One of the reasons we were so keen to get you on is because our listeners and readers, by and large, share your view that broadcasting is almost unrecognisable from what it was when you began working in it in the 1980s. Now, you've recently added a postscript to your brilliant 2023 memoir, Confessions, Life Reexamined, to coincide with the publication of your paperback at the end of January. Now, if you didn't buy the hardback, listeners, and even if you did, the paperback is worth buying for Ed's extremely incisive and articulate postscript about the changes he's witnessed. Now, Ed, I find it so interesting because while there is certainly much to deplore, with your habitual propensity for fairness, you say that having to keep up with those radical shifts have forced everyone in your field to become less sloppy and more vigilant about where the truth lies, given we're now faced with multiple versions of it over numerous platforms. I know it's a huge topic, but can you start by telling our listeners a bit about those changes you've seen firsthand before we get on to you personally?
What's happened really came home to me during those terrifying far-right riots in the summer, which, as you remember, followed the awful stabbing of those young girls in Southport. And the riots took off following a rumour that got round online in that way that things go viral, that the killer was a Muslim and a small boats immigrant. And what was really striking about it was that even when it became apparent that that wasn't true, and it was done very deliberately because the person accused is a juvenile, but the judge deliberately lifted the ban on identifying him to make the point that he wasn't what people had been thinking he was. Even when the truth came out very clearly, people, in many cases, paid no attention to it and went on rioting as they had done before. I was, as it happens, presenting The World This Weekend that week, and we did a sort of timeline of the way the week had unfolded, and that just struck me very forcefully. And I think it brings home the challenges of operating now in a world where people can choose between, as they sometimes see it, multiple truths, as you say. And if you think all the information that you get from all sorts of different sources is, broadly speaking, of equal value, you will inevitably choose the truth you like, the one that suits your ideas or your prejudices. And I think that's what we saw happening that week. And I think the events of the week brought home just what a dangerous thing that is and the price you pay when the idea of truth and the idea of trust in the people who tell you things are shaken. And in fact, the idea of truth itself is called into question. And it is, of course, a very, very different world from the one I began broadcasting in, when there were only three television channels back then in 1979. There was, of course, you know, it's amazing to think that. Isn't
amazing
it?
To think that. I know. I still say, what side is it on?
yeah. Well, I joined ITN in the middle of the most extraordinary strike, which is unthinkable now. The technicians on ITV generally went on strike, and for the first 2 months of my working life, there was no ITV transmission at all. And it was recorded afterwards that some people had just turned the telly on and watched the test card anyway, because they were so used to watching. Anyway, it's a completely different world. And in those days, enormous trust was placed in telly news in particular, much more than in newspapers. So you felt very privileged working in television news and a great sense of obligation to get it right. And today it is a very different landscape. And in a funny sort of way, the sense of obligation is every bit as strong now as it was then, precisely because we're fighting, you know, we're fighting all these forces. And I think that people like me who've worked in, you know, mainstream broadcast journalism for all these years, firstly, have to be very honest about the fact that things weren't always wonderful in those days. What one instance sticks in my memory was when I joined ITN. It was the middle of the Iranian hostage crisis, when the Revolutionary Guards in Tehran were holding the staff of the American embassy there hostage. And pretty much every day there'd be a demonstration outside the embassy and somebody would burn an American flag. And, you know, we'd just run little pictures of this in most of our bulletins. And then one day someone rang up after the show and said, can you explain why those Iranian students were chanting death to America in Spanish? And of course, somebody had picked up, you know, the bit of video and thought, oh, well, that must be the Iranians. And it was broadcast. It wasn't the end of the world, but it was an example of the kind of complacency that can creep in. You know, if you've got the mastery of the nation's attention like that. So I think it's quite a good thing that we are tested in a way that we weren't. But we have to step up to the plate and show that we are worthy of that trust.
I've been reading Mariana Spring's new book, Conspiracy Land. She obviously has become the correspondent for the BBC. She's looking into the whole other universe of platforms and trolling and all that sort of thing. And yeah, she's very interesting about it, because she's saying basically that in a way, the establishment, what you stand for, in if you like, has people view that as much a part of the conspiracy against truth as standing up for it.
Yes, I think that's very much true. And it does increase the obligation on us to prove that we are actually worthy of being judged in a slightly different way to something you pick up on, you know, on social media, and that anything that we say or broadcast has been through that process that's called editing. In other words, it's been analysed and judged and thought about. And, you know, we can't all claim to be the world's leading experts, and of course we get things wrong, but it's been that editing process has taken place mostly by people who spent their whole lives doing that stuff. You know, and have devoted their careers to getting those judgments right. When I did, you very kindly mentioned the book I did about the BBC. And one of the things that was really interesting and struck me is that in the early days of the war, the phony war, in other words, when not much was happening, it really was politics as usual at Westminster. And the BBC files are full of angry letters from the TUC complaining that the Tories are on all the time, and from one cabinet minister complaining that somebody else is getting the Sunday slot, all that kind of stuff. And as soon as you get to the summer of 1940, an existential threat to the country, a coalition government at Westminster, the whole nation suddenly focused on surviving, that changes completely. You can see it's getting confidence as a result of this. It can do exciting new things. It can begin broadcasting much more frequently into France and trying to influence events there, starting services all over the world, George Orwell piling in to talk to India. All that sort of stuff is going on because they're liberated from day-to-day kind of political scrapping.
When you're at the Today programme, I remember talking to you before about the role of the presenter, and I remember you saying it is the presenters.
I don't really say that. I mean, because I'd hate to talk down the producers who, you know, make it happen. The presenters, certainly when I was there, came in at 4 o'clock in the morning And there was a mass of research done overnight. There's also actually rather a nice, enjoyable dynamic, which is that the presenters tend to be grumpy old men and women. And, well, you know, it was me and Jim and John and Sue McGregor, and, you know, we were all quite of a certain, we'd knocked about a bit, put it that way. And because of the physical demands of working on a programme like that, all the producers are incredibly young, brilliant young men and women. It's very, very invigorating to be working with people much younger than you, and watching them learn as you did when you were young, and also actually being enthused, I find, today by people complaining about, you know, standards going down and so forth. These, I can't call them kids, that would be, you know, they're in their 20s and 30s, but they're so dedicated and so kind of clever and thoughtful.
I think our listeners would just want to know about the story of you leaving the Today programme, because it did, there was such a surge of support for you, and if anybody's read your memoir, there's a wonderful chapter in it called Sending the Butler with the Brandy and the Revolver, all about that. So just remind our listeners about what happened, because it made a lot of people very cross.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. There's a great bit of advice from Saint Augustine, which I commend to anybody who finds themselves in similar circumstances, which is feeling resentment is like drinking poison and hoping the other person will die.
Famously quoted by Nelson Mandela too.
Oh, was it? I didn't know that. Oh, right. Yes. What can I say? But it's very good, because it is true that if you just get, naturally, of course, you're angry when you lose a job that you loved. I had no idea it was coming. I was addressing a literary lunch in Harrogate, as it happens. And I'd been interviewed a few days before by a journalist from The Independent. And when I came out of the lunch, I turned my phone off, of course, while I was giving a talk. I found a message from him saying, there's a little squib in the mail suggesting you're about to be fired. Is it true? Oh. So I rang up my boss, the editor, and he said, well, yes, it is, essentially. Yeah, that was how I found out. A lot of the sympathy that you talk about, I think, sprang from the feeling that the BBC had sort of cocked it up. I mean, of course, they had a perfect right not to renew my contract. I mean, that's, you know, there's no, however disappointed and hard done by I might feel, that's the name of the game. But I think because they did it in such a cack-handed way, it meant I did get a lot of sympathy. And there was even an early day motion in Parliament asking for me to get my job back, which, anyway, so it was a brouhaha, but it was also incredibly heartwarming and actually taught me something really important about Radio 4 in particular. It's such a beloved network, and it goes so far back, right, we're talking about the Second World War, right back to the Home Service during the Second World War.
Yes.
That the listeners feel it belongs to them and not to us, and that they are the real bosses. I sort of thought, well, that they are my real bosses, and they seem to like what I do, so I shouldn't feel so bad about the fact that a couple of BBC bosses don't feel so good about what I do.
No, but I think you were sacked at a time, and you defined that moment when there started to be a movement generally against poshness on air.
Certainly lots of people said that at the time. One or two people I've talked to who were involved in the decisions subsequently say that it certainly wasn't explicitly a factor.
No.
So I'm also actually slightly reluctant to moan about that, because I think in my early life, when poshness was a hurrah word and not a boo word, I did very well. One of the sort of really frightening details looking back is that when I got my job at IGN as a trainee, I subsequently became friend of the managing editor's secretary. And she said, you know, when we were choosing trainees, and a very good bunch they were, there's Mark Damser, who became controller of Radio 4, Michael Crick, you know, very distinguished.
Yes. Yes.
And me were the three. And she said the secretary said that her boss had instructed her to go through the applications for traineeship and throw away any that weren't from people who'd been at Oxford and Cambridge.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, well, exactly, gosh. And so I think with that in mind, I'm quite wary about going into a rant about getting into trouble for being posh later in life. IGN in those days was a world which was very much divided between old school tabloid green eyeshade men, mostly, in fact, almost all of them, and then a kind of sprinkling of brainy graduates. And the Green Eyeshade Brigade really enjoyed sort of punishing the brainy trainees. One of my earliest memories of is walking into the ITN newsroom wearing my pinstripe suit, because my mum said that that's what you wore when you went to the office, and the news editor shouting across the newsroom, "Oi, you trainee, go to Brixton and find an escaped prisoner." And there'd been a story, I think the Sun or the Mirror, suggesting that some of the prisoners were nipping over the wall in the evenings and having a drink in the local pub. So I literally went down to Brixton and sidled up to sort of large people in pubs and said, "Are you a drink, mate? Don't suppose by any chance you're an escaped prisoner, are you?"
Did you not get beaten up?
I was quite large, so but it wasn't my proudest moment, but probably very good for me.
So can we go back now, because you know, talking about your time as an ITN trainee, you said at one time that's when you found it very addictive and you realised you were good at it. And I think the turning point was when you were covering the release of the Libyan hostages, when you discovered in yourself, I think, because you were stuck on the plane, that you could do that ad-libbing with great confidence and sounding unruffled.
We're talking about, I suppose, 84, probably, thereabouts.
Oh, so you were still very young then.
Very young. And, yeah. And it was also, Channel 4 News had just started. And, of course, lots of people thought that it was never going to last. So a lot of us, including me, got very good jobs very early on. And it was also a time of experimentation with live broadcasting, which was becoming more and more possible to do. And people were moving from film, goodness me, think about it, which was still there when I joined, where you'd have to bring your film back to the office and it would have to be put in the bars,
yes,
40 minutes before you had a chance to cut it, all that sort of stuff. And suddenly you could, A, you could record things on tape, but B, you could broadcast live with a van from all sorts of places. And we discovered that there was a plane. Terry Waite had negotiated the release of a group of hostages that had been, British hostages had been held in Libya, as you say. And we discovered the plane was due to arrive at Gatwick at precisely the moment that we went on the air. And the wonderful Stuart Purvis, who was the editor at that time, who's a very adventurous and innovative television journalist, said, "Right, go down to Gatwick, we'll have an OB, and we'll see the plane land, and you can commentate, and you can, you know, tell us what's happening, and it'll be really exciting." And I went down, and in fact, the plane did arrive as advertised, just as we were going on the air. And I was there, you know, describing what was happening and saying how important it was. And then the plane taxied to a stop, and nothing happened. At this point, it became apparent that just having one camera, which we had, was tricky, partly because it was raining. So the image of the plane every so often was obscured by the cameraman's hand coming across the lens and sort of wiping it. And Stuart, bless him, who was back in the control room, says, "Great, great. Stay with them until the hostages come off the plane." And the minutes ticked by, and nothing happened. And luckily, I'd bought some notes I'd done for Alistair Burnett, the newsreader, when he was covering the Pope's visit when he arrived at Gatwick, I think the previous year. So I pulled them out and started filling in the audience with all sorts of fascinating stuff about Gatwick Airport. I think we even described the name of the plane at some length. Anyway, I'm not sure I should say this publicly, the reason for the delay. Anyway, after about sort of 40 minutes, I think they gave up. But I had really enjoyed it, and it earned me lots of brownie points with the boss, because I managed to keep gassing on in very unpromising circumstances.
You also loved your time as a Channel 4 correspondent in America, didn't you?
I did.
But you went back to America recently and hated it. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, two things. One, it reminded me that reporting is always, always the best job in the world, because you just go somewhere and you're immediately struck by things that you can't be struck by without being there, without, you know, eating there, talking to people, or just feeling the place. And one weird thing that struck me, and this is relevant to our earlier conversation about multiple truths, when I was based in Washington, I always found one of the great pleasures of arriving in a new city, particularly on the East Coast, is there would be banks of machines, metal sort of boxes on the streets with newspapers in them. I was in Atlanta for the American presidential election, and I couldn't find a newspaper in downtown Atlanta. The hotel didn't have them. They looked at me as if I was completely mad when I said, can I have a newspaper with my breakfast? I went searching on the streets.
How fascinating.
I even went into a shop called The Newsagent. I said, they said, no, we don't sell newspapers. We're just called The Newsagent. And I thought that was just, I thought, culturally really interesting.
Yes.
And must tell you something about the way that people are consuming information. And the other thing which I did find very depressing is it's such a divided society. It really is. I mean, I know that's a truism and everybody says it, but until you feel it, I was at the Republican, well, victory parties, it turned out, on election night in Atlanta. And the sheer sort of venom with which people spoke about the other side was, I mean, one of the speakers got up on the stage and said, we're getting rid of Kamala Harris. We're putting out the garbage.
Oh, God.
And it was so, you know, when I was based in Washington, it was, we thought at the time, quite polarized. Ronald Reagan was in the White House. But it was nothing like this. It was much more kind of, I don't know, gentler and more civilized in a way. And I found that depressing, because I'd been really won over by moving there as a young man. And having been, you know, slightly sort of snooty English and European about Americans, I completely fell in love with the place and its energy and the way lots of the things that we get hung up about, like class, just didn't matter to people.
Yeah.
They didn't even understand what you're talking about. And I found all that very exciting. So it was rather sad to go back this time. And leave not really wanting to go back again. I mean, of course I will, but, you know, just leaving with a sense it wasn't a happy place.
Can we now talk about you personally for a minute? Because it's no secret that you have terminal cancer. And I just wonder, obviously, there's been so much around the assisted dying bill, and also you're very well known for your Catholic faith. What do you think about all of that, Ed?
No, well, I think I'd probably prefer to say incurable rather than terminal.
Sorry.
I probably will die of it in the end. But I think, you know, you say you're terminal when somebody has said to you, you've got 3 months or whatever it is. One of the things I've learned through having cancer is that it's really important to talk about it, to talk about the different stages that you can be at. And in some senses, I'm really lucky. I mean, I've been diagnosed more than 10 years ago, and yet they've kept me propped up. And, you know, that, even though it is, as you say, it is incurable. And I bet you feel you're slightly hijacking the position of people who are looking at a terminal diagnosis, which I probably will do one day. But if you then, you know, you include yourself in the terminal bracket, if you like. Chris Hoy, for example, who's got the same thing as I have, but was diagnosed much, much later in the disease. He said the other day, I've been given, you know,
time limit.
Years.
They put a time limit on it.
And that, of course, is, you know, one of the factors in the bill is that the requirement is that you
6 months.
And I think it's partly important for people who have cancer to make these distinctions, because when I was diagnosed as being incurable, and the doctor said to me, he said, but listen, a lot of people learn to live with cancer.
Yes.
At the time, I felt like saying, come on, come on, you know, in a Today programish sort of way, you mean dying of cancer from where I'm sitting, not living with it. But actually, he was completely right. And I have lived with it for many years now. And I think, you know, if people are aware that you can do that, it makes a big difference. It doesn't make the word cancer quite so terrifying. If you can hang on, it ain't so bad, really. I don't think of it very much. Every 3 months I have a checkup, and it's a bit like getting your A-level results. You know, you're scared beforehand. But here I am.
Well, I think what's amazing about you, Ed, I remember when we talked about your cancer before, and what I extracted from that conversation was that you've really understood where your sources of joy are, which aren't just in your faith, but they're in your marriage, your life in France. And
it does do that to you a bit. It makes you work out what you really treasure. I think, you know, the idea that I wake up every morning and think, oh, I've got a limited amount left, I must have great fun today. And it's not as crude as that, I don't think. But it does make you sort out your priorities and what you really care about. And you know, they are the things that you've just mentioned. And actually, I find writing and broadcasting too. I do care about those. I really enjoy them. You know, there's a temptation to say, God, I'm ill, I better give up work. But no, I really miss it.
I think that's so true. And I think that's so true of a lot of oldies who are forced out of work, you know, for one reason or another. And it's your life. I mean, it's certainly my life working. I love it.
Well, I think we are very lucky to work in a profession where that's true, where you can go on for as long as you feel up to it and as long as people
feel you're up to it.
Well, happen to read your stuff or listen to your broadcast or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And of course, the oldies are wonderful. Extension of people's lives in that way, isn't it?
And it is.
And you know, readers, I am sure, feel that because it's there and it's got a community and it has fun, it sort of is a recognition that old people can do that. I'm not that old anyway, but
so just back to your faith a minute. I mean, you have described it before as a work in progress. Has it got deeper?
I don't think it has particularly. I think you would think, wouldn't you, that if you are confronting the end of your life, even if it's, you know, not tomorrow, you would think more cheerfully about it if the idea of an afterlife is part of your belief system.
Yeah.
But I don't find I think about that at all, really. And I find that when I think about it, I think my faith and the ideas associated with it and the way I learned Catholicism when I was young are really things that are the lens that I look through to see this life, in a way. I think it gives you a particular approach to the world, a bit of seriousness about what you do, a sense of moral obligation, a belief and confidence, to go back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, in truth.
Yeah.
And the idea that, you know, there is such a thing as truth, and an appreciation of the wonders of the world. The idea that you can almost see God reflected in the beauty around you. That last one, of course, brings up a difficult journalistic thing to reconcile, which is many of my colleagues, even some of whom, you know, began their lives as believers, find the suffering that they have seen very difficult to reconcile with the idea of the, which, you know, and I couldn't question that.
Yeah.
And I also find, I'd have to be honest, and so I found that the kind of endless, unrelenting revelations over the last, 15, no more, 20 years, 25 years about abuse.
Yes.
It's just, I mean, it really makes it difficult sometimes to go on having faith in the institution of the church, certainly. And you know, so there was a period, I think, when I was first started doing the Sunday programme regularly, when every weekend I'd climb on a train to Salford, which was where we broadcast from, and the knowledge I get another ghastly story about Catholic priests abusing children, and I find that that is difficult.
Because you went to school at Ampleforth, and I remember you were absolutely horrified when that scandal first burst.
Yes, I was. And even more so, I mean, the person I felt really sorry for actually was my dad, who had I would say troubled childhood in the sense of because he was very privileged in many ways, but he spent the war in South Africa. His mother was, my grandmother was torpedoed and killed on a troop ship going to see her husband and my grandfather, who was in aid. And my dad he lost his mum and he didn't see his father at all because aid was considered too dangerous for him and his siblings. And he came back, I think, as a 16-year-old to Ampleforth at the end of the war, having been put on a ship in Durban and not knowing who was going to meet him at the other end.
Oh.
I think when he went, he was then dispatched to Ampleforth. He was probably, of course, different times, and you don't talk about damaged children and so forth, but, he'd been through a hell of a lot for a teenager.
Yes.
And he felt very much that the monks had rescued him.
Yes.
And given him a sense of direction and a set of beliefs and a kind of approach to life that stayed with him for the rest of his life, really. And he was absolutely shattered when those revelations first came out.
I'm not surprised, because you did want you described the to me once that the Catholic model is sort of life is a journey with a moral destination.
Yes,
which becomes a part of everyone who goes to Ampleforth.
You touch on something quite important there, which is that the standards by which many of us now judge the individuals and indeed the institution, are the standards that they taught us.
Yes.
You know what I mean? They taught us to make judgments and to see the difference between right and wrong, and so clearly people didn't. I was a huge fan of Cardinal Hubes, who was the abbot at Ampleforth when I was there, and then went on to be Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster.
Who married you? Your first marriage, indeed.
He did, indeed, yes. Indeed. I bumped into him through my broadcasting career. And I think I actually did the last public interview he did, which was very characteristic. There'd been a nail bomb attack on a gay pub in Soho.
Yes, I remember.
Do you remember that?
And yes, I do.
He took care just to squash any notion of, Catholics not caring about gay people. He came onto the Today programme and was absolutely rigorous in his condemnation of what had happened. And it was after he'd told everyone that he was dying of cancer, and his voice was quite shaky. And I just thought, what a good and clever way to use your office, and to go on being determined to do that even when you were very ill. And then, of course, it comes out not that he was an abuser, but he did indeed, in the case of one particular priest who subsequently went to jail for what he'd done. He, when accusations were made against this priest, Basil Hume sent him out to parishes away from the boys, but it was more normal to do that in those days. There are lots of things one can say about different attitudes at different times. But it's upsetting to find one of your heroes has clay feet, had done something like that. And the other interesting thing I think I found about that whole period is that some of my contemporaries are looking back now on their time at the school with very different eyes. And I think we all perhaps suppress things then. Even looking back at my own diaries, I can see hints of things not being quite as, as we would wish them to be by today's standards. The other bigger point, in a way, but it does sort of apply to those of us who went to Ampleforth and schools like it, is that very often the families that are most damaged by abuse are those which are closest to the church. You know, so if you, your son is an altar boy, he's in, you know, he's vulnerable, or was. It's not, of course, uniquely Catholic. I mean, we're talking just after the resignation of the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Indeed,
which is an extraordinary event.
Anyway, on a happier note,
yes, okay.
Your memoir is being published in paperback in January. And what else are you writing, Ed?
I'm actually, well, I'm not sure whether I should talk about this, because I've got an idea which my agent is currently circulating to publishers.
Ooh.
And I think I'm not going to tell you, because it might not work. And I feel I'd be putting a jinx on it.
Yes.
So just keep your fingers crossed and I'll let you know.
Ed, thank you very, very much for coming on Radio Oldie.
A great pleasure.
You've been listening to Radio Oldie, sponsored by Baillie Gifford, with me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with the broadcaster and author, Edward Sturton. If you've enjoyed listening to us, you'll find plenty more conversations like this by going to our website, www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. Once again, my warm thanks to Ed. Thank you to Baillie Gifford for supporting us, and thank you for listening. Goodbye.